Welcome to the Civic Commons.
I think a good teacher is a teacher that has, like, a lot of patience. You know, like, a teacher that we wouldn't learn a lot from is, like, a teacher that's kind of burned out and doesn't really say anything. Like, you know, here's some paper, draw, have fun, yay.
But I like the teachers who actually learn stuff, you know, like, instead of just, like, review all the time.
Teacher who has a lot of patience, like he said, doesn't just do review like every time, gives you some new things.
A good teacher is definitely someone who, you know, like, likes their students, you know, they don't hate them, and, you know, become a teacher just because it was the only job available.
That was great. What are those kids' names?
Well, it was Noah, who's my son,
Noah, all disclosure, Frazier.
Noah, Malone, and Narius, and they're all in the third grade.
What school? Roxborough?
Roxborough Elementary.
In Cleveland Heights.
In Cleveland Heights. And I told them they couldn't use specific teacher names for good or not good teachers. It was about passion and patience. That's what they thought made a good teacher.
It's the Civic Commons. I'm Dan Malthrop.
I'm Luke Frazier.
So I'm glad that you did that, because that's the student voice in this conversation is just so important, even if the students are only 9 years old. They know when they have a teacher who's patient and good and is teaching them something new, and they know when they're being asked to just, here's a piece of paper, just draw something. That was hilarious. Last week, Michelle Rhee, formerly of the D.C., Washington, D.C. schools, which was the lowest performing school district in the nation for a long time. Well, she made headlines for the last 5 years in really shaking up that district. Anyway, she came to town. She was speaking at the City Club of Cleveland. It was a very, little context here, it was a very sort of big-wiggy kind of event. Mm. She was brought in by the Greater Cleveland Partnership, who presumably paid her way. Nobody gets paid for speaking at the City Club. They just get to do it because that's where you want to speak. Mm-hmm. But so there were big, you know, big groups from the Greater Cleveland Partnership. The CEO of the Cleveland Schools, interim CEO Peter Raskin, was there. CEO of the Cleveland Foundation, Ron Richard, who is really, really investing and looking for ways to push education reform, get the Cleveland Foundation involved in that. He was there. Lots of people from the county were there, people from the city, but not a lot of teachers, because it was the middle of the day on a Wednesday. Mm. And the teachers union, I didn't see any union reps there. There may have been some union reps there, but it seemed like there was something missing.
Right.
So today I wanted to get a union rep in, and a current teacher, and who could really talk about in response to some of these issues that Michelle Rhee was raising. So we have one here. Could you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Eileen Sweeney. I'm with Shaker Heights City Schools. I am a special educator with the Woodbury Elementary teaching staff. I have a master's degree in administration, and I currently am the chairwoman of a group of concerned Shaker educators that have gotten together to work on some political issues to make sure that our voices are heard in the process with all the changes in the state budget and with the SB 5 issues that are coming up.
How long have you been teaching, Eileen?
This is my 18th year.
Your 18th year?
Yes.
So you've seen a lot come and go.
A lot come and go. You know, the changes across education and how we deliver services have radically changed, and I think for the better. We're looking at trying to utilize our resources more effectively, and we're also looking at trying to improve our methodology so that kids can learn more effectively.
How do you see the current climate in education and the political climate, and also but the broader climate? I mean, you have groups that didn't exist before, like Democrats for Education Reform, which is really taking a very different sort of stance than Democrats would have taken on union issues and education issues 10 years ago.
The climate is very different. I think that it's increased for the better. There is various groups that have stepped up to have shared partnerships with the political forces, with the educational policy creators, to help have that shared vision of improving student performance and improving their outcomes for their futures. I believe that is a process that is inherent with conflict. but that it is, that conflict is necessary for change. Mm. I really think the more shareholders we have at the table, the better resources we put towards education.
Yeah. So as Dan said, Michelle Rhee was here. Mm-hmm. And before the show, you were telling me that you're very familiar with Ms. Rhee and some of her work. How do you know her?
Well, Michelle Rhee was first came on the scene several years ago and was interviewed with 60 Minutes about her very controversial approach to changing her district and her district's outcomes. Her approach came from an opinion that we needed to radically go in and look at teacher performance. We needed to take accountability for all the factors in administration as well and how we deliver the service. Her approach also included merit pay. Her approach included elimination of tenure. Her approach also included the closing of local schools. She seems to be quite a big advocate for looking outside the box, which I think is a refreshing point of view. I don't always agree with her direction. I'm not a big advocate myself for charter schools or what you would call the voucher program. Those are great alternatives if they work, and I'm right now a little doubtful about the effectiveness of some or most of those programs. Mm.
So we have some clips, Dan.
Yeah, I want to start with one that doesn't actually have to do with either of those things that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. charter schools and vouchers, but is actually about, she kind of frames this argument. She was telling a story about her first year when she was really rolling heads. She started talking about going to city council and testifying before city council in Washington, D.C., and explaining what she was up to.
Probably the most interesting day I had in the whole 3.5 years that I was in that job was the day that we had the city council hearing about that legislation. And we had scores of people, you know, coming in and testifying and leaving. And during the entire, I think it was 14-hour-long meeting, you heard very, very little talk about children, about schools, or student achievement. All of the talk was about adults and job security and protections. And somebody asked me along the way in the process, don't you believe, Chancellor Rhee, that an ineffective teacher could be made better through professional development? And I said, perhaps, but let us not let children languish in their care in the meantime. And especially when we know the statistics, right? We know from the data and the research, specifically for poor and minority kids, if they have 3 highly effective teachers in a row versus 3 ineffective teachers in a row, it can literally change their life trajectory. Teacher, are we willing to sacrifice 2/3 of the kid's chance in life so that we can professionally develop 2 adults? And I'm saying the answer is right or wrong. I'm just saying those are the kinds of questions that we have to be asking ourselves every day and the dilemma that we were in.
That's Michelle Rhee, former D.C. schools chief. Now she is the executive director of an organization called Students First, which is a national organization seeking to push a certain education reform agenda. Eileen Sweeney, what do you think about what you just heard?
Well, my first impression is absolutely in agreement with her that we have to take a close look at ineffective teachers. I think that there isn't a teacher hired right now that doesn't agree with the fact that we need to constantly improve, and that there are teachers that definitely need to look at improving professionally, that actively engage more to become better at their practice. There are tenure teachers that maybe shouldn't be tenured and maybe should look for employment other places. But we're talking about the minority of teachers. The majority of the teachers out there do not qualify under the conditions that Michelle is describing. They are highly professional, highly trained teachers delivering services in our public schools every day.
But I think her point about, well, what if you, if, as a parent, what if my child had the unfortunate circumstance of going to a teacher who was on some kind of continuum, not a great teacher, but was still employed or maybe still had tenure, but needed more professional development and even were going to get it, but maybe not right then.
And I agree with that. I completely agree that that's a concern, and I do believe that that is an issue that the school districts and the unions have currently agreed the status quo is. But that doesn't mean we take away collective bargaining rights. We need to go back and revisit the tenure issue and go back and revisit how we engage our teachers in professional development and how we support them through processes of development.
She didn't say anything about collective bargaining in that particular cut. I mean, she was saying that...
Let's be transparent. She did bring it up during the address, and we've got a link. We have a link to the whole thing at theciviccommons.com. I should mention, too, that this is all, you know, this was all done with a lot of help from the City Club. But she did say, specifically regarding tenure and regarding the law in the state of Ohio, that last hired, first fired law that the union pushed for years ago is unconscionable. She essentially said it's ridiculous in this day and age that that's how we deal with layoffs. It puts the concerns of adults, as she just said, over the concerns of students. In general, the conversation's focus, she says, too much on adults and their needs and not enough on students and their needs.
I think that the driving force has to be about what the needs of the students are, but we have to examine the adults at a level of how we meet those needs. And the bottom line is that we definitely need to re-examine tenure and professional growth. For instance, there's a proposal out there about how we go into an internship type of program, similar to the medical profession, of bringing new graduates from colleges and bring them along through an internship to build their proficiency at their craft. Those are options that we can look at preparing teachers to help meet the needs of students. We always start with students. We talk about teachers a lot, because we need to know how we're responding to the student need. Tenure is something we decide on together with administrations, with school districts, and with unions at the bargaining table. They have agreed to these terms as much as the unions have. And so we need to, through a collaborative process, change and improve.
What do you think should be done about tenure? You said we should revisit it.
I think that we need to revisit it in the sense of maybe expanding the years, the process, and the qualifications of getting tenure and developing proficiency and professionalism. I think that most unions and union leadership will agree with that. Eliminating it in general is something that has to be decided at the negotiating table. But I will also say that administrations in school districts have rubber stamped many of the teachers that we have in our classrooms and haven't put them through rigorous examination in the 3 years required. I think if there was more due diligence, we wouldn't have ineffective teachers in our classrooms.
But you know what, Eileen, we're talking with Eileen Sweeney here at the Civic Commons. Tenure is tenure, though. It's permanent after. Let's say the bar does get raised.
Mm-hmm.
But once they're in that club, they will remain there. And we heard our little third graders analysts at the beginning, and they said, well, when a teacher is kind of burned out, you know, and how is tenure, where a teacher that may have started in all kinds of passion and all kinds of, you know, idealism now has less of that?
Tenure is a tricky issue in that regard, but I do agree with your third grader that we need to look at best teachers being somebody who is excited and patient in our classrooms. And I really do believe that true professionals come into the teaching profession looking at making a difference. And yes, burnout can happen to a degree, but I think that there is a commitment level when you enter into the education department that you are definitely committed to helping individuals. And I really don't believe over time our professionals in general lose that passion.
Mm. Real quick on tenure, I have a friend who's going for tenure at Case Western Reserve University right now. He is so stressed out because he's got to put together this whole packet, and it's a major deal. That's really different from the tenure process for public school teachers.
That process must be rigorous, and it must not necessarily be rubber stamped in.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. Let's move on to another point. This is one of the first stories she told, and it has to do with a teacher who cost the district, by two mistakes, cost the district $500,000.
Let me just give you an example of the madness. He said, I was, you know, looking through the files of these children that we're sending to these private schools and we're paying the tuition. He said, and I found an example of one employee that we happen to have. And she made two mistakes. On one kid, she didn't have a meeting she was supposed to have. And on another kid, she didn't fill out a form she was supposed to fill out. And because of those two egregious errors, she actually cost the district a tremendous amount of money, because both of these kids ended up getting sent to a private placement that cost the district $227,000 per year per kid in tuition. So my special assistant calls the woman and says, ma'am, we need you to come to a meeting at the chancellor's office tomorrow at 5 o'clock. So I had the files in front of me. I said, you know, this kid, you didn't fill out the form. This kid, you didn't have the meeting. Help me understand what happened. Because you cost this district nearly $500,000 with these two mistakes. And she looked at me and she said, well, you need to understand that I'm a very busy person. And I have too much to do. There's so much that has to get done in any given day. I've got too many kids in my caseload. So things are going to fall through the cracks. That's just the way that it is. And I looked at her and I said, no, you need to understand that if you believe this job is too big for you, then you need to go find another job. But if you are going to take the paycheck home every other week, then you have to take responsibility for doing everything within your job purview and doing it well.
That's Michelle Rhee again addressing an audience at the City Club of Cleveland last week. Eileen Sweeney, you're a special educator. I was at the event, and I heard her telling that story, and I made a note. I was taking some notes, and I said, special ed is really hard. And I used to be a teacher, and I know that teaching is, there's stuff that falls through the cracks all the time. It is one of the most busy jobs imaginable. So, and I thought that's where she was going with that story. And then she wasn't. And I was sort of, you know, set back on my heels a little bit.
She is right about a couple things. Number one, if we're going to be in classrooms and teach our children about our responsibilities, we should be meeting our responsibilities. That's what stood out for me. We should be the models of how we're meeting our responsibilities. Second, special ed is a unique situation in education. There are more procedural guidelines dictated by law that we have to file appropriately and meet due dates, and the level of diligence is higher than a regular ed teacher has to administer every day.
As a when I was teaching high school English, there was never a situation where any mistake that I made could have cost the district $500,000. Mm.
These are obscure things. And what this type of situation that she's referring to is possibly a complying with an EMIS report that has due dates that are required by special ed law. And if the parent has a lawyer, they can start contesting the administration of the IEP, which is an individual education program, and it gives them more consideration in a court of law. And what usually
and then the court can order that the child be placed elsewhere at the district's expense.
Well, but usually what happens, our school districts do not like to go into courts because they cost money. So what will happen is that they will go to due process and stop the process and then replace the child and agree with the party to send the child to another placement.
So let's pull back, though, from mm-hmm. the specifics of the special ed example and think about the real message of what she's saying there, which is, sure, the job is tough, and there's a lot of requirements no matter where you are in a school, whether you're in a special ed situation mm-hmm. or you're teaching physical education. It's a tough job. It's right. demanding. And if you don't want to do it, you don't have to.
I was struck by the laughter in that clip. That when the teacher went to the office and or was reminded that Ms. Rhee was her supervisor, ultimately, you know, we all kind of chuckled. You know, the relationship between the teachers and administration is very important. Did that teacher get the support she needed to understand the kind of requirements that were put upon special education? I don't know. This is all conjecture. But it occurs to me that teachers, you know, with that kind of tough responsibility, maybe there are systematic ways to help them or do some fail-safe maneuvers where something like that can't happen.
And that's exactly right. You know, you have to streamline the process so those mistakes don't happen. And effective administrations do that.
If these changes that are proposed in the budget go through, and if in the hypothetical future, 3 years from now, there's SB5, whatever legal hurdles SB5 had to get over are through, and we wind up without any collective bargaining for teachers, then there's this opportunity to reinvent what teacher contracts look like. Mm-hmm. And there was a student at this event who asked, "What can students do?" Ms. Rhee's answer has a particular bearing on this question.
Hi, my name is Philip Williams. I'm from St. Martin de Porres, and our saying is transforming one Cleveland urban student at a time. And my question was, what can students do to help education reform?
I think that students can play a huge role in the reform effort. And in fact, I would say that students and student voice is the thing that is most undervalued in school districts. So I had a what I called a student cabinet, and it was a group of students from every single high school in the city was represented, and they came and met with me every 3 weeks or so, and we would talk about policy issues. And it was very interesting because, for example, when we put together our new teacher evaluation system, we rolled it out to the student cabinet, and we kind of said, okay, here's what it looks like, here's what it's going to measure. And what the kids said to me was, well, here one thing that you're not taking into account is our point of view about teacher quality. Because I've seen your little evaluators come in, and then, you know, the teacher perks up and does a whole lot of things that they weren't, you know, they've never done before. We see them every day, and we can tell you there are tremendous numbers of great teachers in the system and some, you know, not so good. But because we see it every day, we can actually evaluate that better. So we put in place a pilot program for this year where we would actually get student feedback and input and triangulate that with the teacher evaluation data. In the interim, a study by the Gates Foundation came out a few months ago that said that they did this research, and they showed that how the students were rating teachers was very highly correlated to student achievement levels.
Eileen Sweeney, what do you think about including student evaluations as a metric in among a group of metrics?
Well, let's think of it from a business point of view. There's not a business out there that's not going to measure their consumer. Otherwise, it's ineffective. I think that at some point, we need to look at the validity of the voices of our students as well. I am not afraid, and no good teacher is afraid to include that as a marker for evaluation. I really do believe that even in the worst classrooms that I have taught in, that if I had an invested relationship, no matter what kind of day it is, even if it was a worst day, my students knew I was invested in helping them improve. And that relationship helped me become a better teacher for them. That is not something I, as a teacher, should be afraid to include in my evaluations.
But so how is this related then to the idea that how your students perform on tests or certain markers or metrics ought to reflect back on the teacher?
Are you speaking about value added?
Well, you should explain what value added is.
Okay, value added is a way that the state looks at areas such as poor performing groups and try to measure the improvements and use the improvements in student performance as one way to evaluate teacher performance.
If you want students to be reading at grade level, but you've got a group of students who are reading three grades below grade level, and in the course of a year, you bring them two grades up, you should be given credit for that. You shouldn't be penalized because they're still reading below grade level.
So it's context, and it's where a group starts.
Right. That's sort of simplifying it, but is that...
It's identifying high-poverty schools as schools that have more factors that impact the student performance. So we should compensate for that in our measures. When you go on to Michelle Rhee's website for her students first, they talk about value added as tied to teacher performance and teacher evaluation, looking at three different factors. We should look at value added for a system of weighing these difficult classrooms. My opinion on that is I don't really have confidence in their ability to actually weigh properly the factors as the geography changes. I look at what happened in Cleveland today. Our geography changed in Cleveland today. We heard from the superintendent that they're going to lay off, what was the number, excuse me?
650 teachers, I think.
Right. 650 teachers and some administrators. Mm-hmm. That's going to geographically change what happens in each classroom. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if value added can properly reflect those changes.
As a teacher in Shaker Heights schools, your level of compensation and the raise that you receive at the end of the year or the beginning of the next year, however you calculate it, is contingent on, one, your years of service, and two, the number of academic credits you have beyond your bachelor's degree.
Correct.
Would you say that those are adequate measurements of what your value?
I would say that those are two adequate measures. Can we add more to more effectively reflect the type of development and implementation that we need to have happen in our classrooms to go back to student performance, come back to the student, not just the teacher, come back to the student.
Lay it out. What should those be? What should those other measurements be?
I don't think there's a teacher out there that we're thinking about that doesn't understand that we need to look at how students perform as one factor. Do we agree on what that looks like? No. Because we know that this isn't all scaled equally. We need to definitely have some type of value added. And we also need to be able to look at schools in a different way. I think that students' views should be included. I do believe that we should also have professional growth. Right now we're looking at eliminating any steps for professional growth. You want a highly trained teacher in your classrooms. Do you want a teacher that has only a bachelor's degree, or do you want the teacher with a master's and an endorsement of reading? Any parent's going to say, I want the teacher with the endorsement in reading. Right now, what SB 5 proposes is no incentive for teachers to go after those type of professional growth opportunities.
Well, SB 5 is really just about changing collective bargaining laws for all public employees that are currently allowed to unionize. It doesn't address specifics about contracts for any of them, does it?
Yes, it does. It does talk about eliminating the step pay, and step pay is tied to increases with professional growth.
True. But it does allow for districts to come up with new ways to compensate.
Absolutely. But that's the problem with SB 5. And that's why you see right now that the House is going back and reworking it, because there's a lot of undefined in the law. It is too ambiguous. What does merit pay look like? What can the district negotiate?
The perception I have is that most teacher unions are basically like, no, we want to keep it the way it is. And they're not willing to say, okay, let's fix this. This doesn't work for everybody and it can be improved. So let's fix it.
If you asked me that question 2-3 years ago, I would agree with you. I think right now our unions unequivocally understand we need to re-examine some things in our contracts and be able to respond because of the economic forces that are going on, and we know we have to make some concessions. We also understand that part of that is also changing the way we do businesses in schools so that our kids are performing better and we're meeting our needs, but also that our schools are much more efficient financially. We understand that we need to meet there. We're not reluctant, but we believe that those issues can be hammered out better collectively in unison with the administration at a collective bargaining negotiating table, rather than being dictated by legislators. I don't believe legislators have the educational background that really can talk about effective administration of education.
Eileen Sweeney is a special educator at Woodbury Elementary School in Shaker Heights, Ohio. She's also a member of the Shaker Heights Education Association. We've been listening as well to excerpts from a recent City Club address by Michelle Rhee. She is the leader of an organization called Students First and formerly the chancellor of the Washington, D.C. Public Schools. You can find out more at our website. That's theciviccommons.com/radio.
Civic Commons Radio is brought to you by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundations and help from the Fund for Our Economic Future.
Our production partner is WJCU at John Carroll University, led by Mark Krieger. And special thanks as well to E.J. Orr.
Our audio editor is Daniel Steinberg of Dim Sum Thinking.
And our production is done by Luke Frazier of Now Productions. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Dan. Have a great week.
You too. Talk to you next week.
What conversations do you want to start? Add your voice at theciviccommons.com.